it's a big wake-up call. The state will have to make tough decisions. This may be one of them.
Considering the future of the proposed Ambler Road. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, undocumented immigrants in Anchorage look for guidance on Obama's immigration action.
To stay far from my family is the most painful in my soul.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight, from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Alaska has more federal land than most states and depends more on federal spending. So Alaska's governors always have a substantial list of priorities they want Congress or the administration to accomplish. Like governors before him, Bill Walker says the item at the top of his federal wish list is opening the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil development. Alaska's congressional delegation has been trying for decades, but Walker believes opening ANWR is politically possible.
I think it is. I think it's I'm not a stranger to that issue, and I've been in D.C. many times over the years on that issue. We've come close in the past. I'd like to, so that is certainly going to be a priority for me, absolutely.
He also wants the Obama administration to expedite all necessary permits and reviews for the Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline. The project is a joint effort of the state and the private sector, but Walker says the feds can help by streamlining the regulatory timetable.
Not bypassing the public involvement or process at all, but rather than necessarily one permit, waiting for the next permit, maybe moving some permits at the same time.
Clearly, money matters. Walker this week submitted a bare-bones capital budget that relies mostly on federal funds. Walker says when it comes to the Kinnick Arm Bridge, which isn't in his first budget, he's concerned about the cost of operation and maintenance.
And we have to sort of try to figure out this incredible deficit, one of the largest in our state's history, is what we're in right now. So it's hard to ignore that.
Alaska, like most states, has an office in Washington, D.C. It has five state employees, led for the past 3 years by Kip Knudsen, the director of state and federal relations. Walker hasn't yet announced who he'll appoint to the job. The federal omnibus spending bill that awaits President Obama's signature contains $100 million for missile defense in Alaska. As KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, it's the only major funding for military construction work in the state this fiscal year.
The spending bill appropriates $50 million for construction work at Fort Greely's Missile Defense Base and another $50 million for design work on a new radar facility elsewhere in Alaska to detect and track incoming enemy missiles. Matt Felling is a spokesman for Senator Lisa Murkowski. He says those appropriations demonstrate the military's confidence in the ground-based mid-course missile defense system after it succeeded in destroying a decoy in a test earlier this year.
And I think that the military realized that we were building a lot of momentum to double down on the funding levels to make sure that everything possible could be done to get our missile defense as strong as possible, as quickly as possible.
Felling says the funding will pay for continued work on Greely's Missile Field 1, one of three at the base. It's part of a $1 billion project approved in 2013 to prepare the base for an expansion that would increase the number of interceptors there from the present 26 to 40 by the end of next year. The other $50 million appropriation will be used to design a facility to house an advanced long-range discrimination radar system. Felling says the military hasn't decided whether to build that facility at Clear Air Force Station near Anderson or at Shemya. Those are the only major appropriations for military construction in Alaska. Felling says the spending bill also contains funding for smaller projects at Fort Wainwright, Eielson Air Force Base, and Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. In Delta, I'm Tim Ellis.
Tribal leaders and stakeholders representing communities that could be impacted by a proposed 220-mile industrial road gathered in Fairbanks to discuss cultural, environmental, and social impacts of the road's potential construction. SKUAC's Emily Schwing reports the meeting is happening at a time when the state is facing difficult budget decisions that could hamper the project.
If built, the industrial road would provide access to the Ambler Mining District, rich in deposits of copper, zinc, lead, silver, and gold. Rick Van Nieuwenhuyse is the CEO of Nova Copper Incorporated, a mining company that would benefit from the road.
The Ambler District is a very special district. It's very high grade. It's the sort of district that can provide jobs for generations because it's very substantial. It's been known about for a long, long time, and it's always been the issue of access.
But funding may also become a problem as the price of oil continues to fall. This week, Alaska Governor Bill Walker slashed more than $100 million from the capital budget, including $8 million that would have gone toward the road project in fiscal year 2016. Van Nieuwenhuyse says he doesn't necessarily see the cut as a setback.
It's a big wake-up call. The state will have to make tough decisions. This may be one of them. There may be other alternatives for financing the continued advancement of the EIS.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, or ADA, is still working on the application to begin a federal environmental impact study. Mike Katze is the Business Development and Communications Director for ADA. He says the governor's recent cut hasn't hindered what's already a long and arduous application and permitting process.
This is a proposed budget. It still has to go through the legislative process. We've been in communications with the governor's office about the project. So right now we're moving forward. We still have, you know, money in our budget till the end of June 2015.
Currently, funding for the project is coming entirely from state dollars appropriated by the legislature. But Katze says if that changes in coming years, there are other ways for ADA to find money.
At ADA, we look at projects from a business perspective. We have to build a business case to move forward with them. So when we make an investment and we're looking at paying for the permitting or moving forward with that, then we would be looking at recouping those funds over the long term of the project.
The state has already spent more than $26 million on feasibility and development studies since 2011. Katze says information from those studies is available on ADA's website. This week, ADA invited a number of representatives from various tribal organizations and villages to Fairbanks to discuss the project. During an interactive presentation, the majority of attendees told ADA they believe more studies on the environmental and cultural impact of the road are needed. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the toll global warming takes on roads and infrastructure in the state.
We're getting freeze-thaw. It's forced us to change the way we do our winter maintenance operations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Togiak Health Clinic was damaged in an apparent burglary earlier this week, and two young men have been identified as the suspects. The only health clinic for the village of 900 residents remains shut down on account of the damages. 18-year-old Brett Pock was arraigned today on three charges: felony criminal mischief, felony burglary, and a misdemeanor theft charge. Pock's alleged co-conspirator is a 17-year-old from Togiak. As a minor, he is unnamed in court documents, but troopers say charges will be referred to the Department of Juvenile Justice. At least $100 in cash and a pair of headphones valued at $160 were stolen from the clinic. Troopers say the two men ripped electrical wires out of the wall in an apparent attempt to knock out surveillance, quote, annihilating the clinic's communication and electrical systems. That damage has caused the loss of communication between the clinic and the Kanakanak Hospital. A hospital spokesperson says good progress is being made on the repairs, and they plan to have the clinic back open tomorrow. A broker established to help individuals sign up for private health insurance has enrolled about 1,000 Alaskans in the first month of the latest open enrollment period. That includes renewals and new signups. Amy Crocker, operations manager for Enroll Alaska, says most of those enrolled by the broker this period have been renewals. Overall, enrollment figures aren't yet available. Alaskans also can sign up themselves. Monday marked the deadline for individuals to sign up for coverage beginning January 1st. People have until February 15th to sign up for 2015 coverage through the federally run online marketplace. An effort to keep Anchorage out of the marijuana regulation process failed last night in the Anchorage Assembly after extensive public comment. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports.
As the largest potential market for commercial marijuana, much of the drive behind the proposed measure was to leverage Anchorage's size to shape how regulations develop in the year ahead. Assemblymember Amy Dembowski was behind the ordinance, which she describes as a wait-and-see approach.
This goes back to an absolute opportunity to negotiate from a position of strength, not to be a follower. And, you know, to me, this is an opportunity to be problem solvers. It's not to be obstructionists. It's literally to look at it and say, okay, what do we do next? And how do we proceed carefully?
Almost 100 people came to last night's meeting, many of them to share their feelings on the marijuana ordinance. The majority of those who spoke during public testimony opposed the ban, citing reasons that spanned the ideological spectrum, appealing to democracy, tax policy, and even scripture as they made their case. Likewise, those testifying to keep commercial marijuana out of Anchorage offered a diverse range of reasons. Jeff Jesse is the CEO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust and believes the state's high rates of substance abuse could become even worse.
We don't need another industry promoting the use and increased use of another intoxicant. Ending prohibition does not necessitate the creation of an industry to promote increased consumption.
After hours of testimony and debate, the Assembly overwhelmingly voted to kill the measure, with Justin Dembowski and Assemblymember Paul Honeman supporting it. Drafting the regulations around marijuana will take months, and some who supported the ballot campaign think the hardest work is still ahead. In February, state legislators will start the year-long process of laying out the specific rules determining permits, taxes, advertisements, all the technical details that come with an industry. Bruce Schulte is with the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation and says after input has been collected from around the state, communities will have 3 months to decide whether the commercial regulations fit local needs.
That three-month window is the appropriate and proper time for any community around the state to look at the statewide rules, consider their own needs and objectives, and then make a decision to opt out or apply additional rules and guidelines of their own. Honestly, what makes sense for Anchorage is going to make just as much sense for Fairbanks, for Bethel, for Nome, for Cots.
The vote doesn't mean Anchorage will automatically opt into regulations once they're done, only that a wait-and-see approach will unfold over a longer timeline. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
About 50 people attended a meeting in Anchorage last night aimed at teaching Alaska's immigrants about President Obama's proposed actions to help immigrants gain legal status. The main message was that you can't apply for any of the programs yet, but you can start preparing documents. KSKA's Ann Hillman found out more.
Elia Lopez moved to Alaska from Mexico 15 years ago in search of a job. I'm not using her real name because she arrived without documents and is here illegally. Because she doesn't have documents, she can't travel. She hasn't seen her parents back home since she arrived.
To stay far from my family is the most painful in my soul for this situation.
Lopez's two children, who are U.S. citizens, have never met their grandparents because they don't want to travel to Mexico without their mother. Lopez says when Obama announced his immigration reforms last month, her family was overjoyed.
When they both listened the news that night, they was crying and yelling at my home because they was thinking they have a possibility to travel with his mom to visit their grandpas.
Under Obama's action, Lopez could potentially be eligible for a 3-year work visa because she has children who are U.S. citizens, and she's been continuously present in the country since before 2010. People who are 16 years old or younger and arrived before 2010 without papers are also eligible. Robin Bronin is the executive director of the Alaska Institute for Justice and is teaching people about the programs. She says 6,000 Alaskans could potentially participate. She says it's a temporary program that would help people while Congress makes decisions on long-term immigration reform.
There is no path to citizenship. There is no lawful permanent residency green cards that will be available to this group of people. It's just a temporary relief from deportation so people can get work permits, social security numbers, driver's licenses, and be fully members of our community.
Bronin says the application period has not started and the specific requirements are not yet set. They know people will need IDs, like passports from their home countries, and they will probably have to pay application fees around $450. They'll also need to prove they were continuously present in the U.S. since December 31st, 2009. Bronin says the Institute for Justice will help people get everything together. The third new immigration program allows children who are escaping violence in Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador to enter as refugees. It will not impact the current refugee resettlement program.
It's trying to find a way of getting those children to safety without having them make that super dangerous journey across multiple borders to reach their parents who are here in the United States.
Bronin says Obama's measures are aimed at keeping families, like Lopez's, together. Lopez says the program finally gives justice to the immigrant community. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Alaska Pacific University offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. Deadline to apply is March 1, 2015. Alaska Pacific University is a private nonprofit offering small class sizes with a student-centered approach in the arts and sciences. More at 1-800-252-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Today, we'll hear the last in KNBA's series on climate change and Alaska Natives. As Jocelyn Estes reports, the effects of warming temperatures on infrastructure can be dramatic.
In much of Alaska, bridges, roads, buildings, and runways have been built on permafrost. That's soil that became frozen during ice ages from 400 to 10,000 years ago, and a few feet down is frozen rock hard year around. Geophysics professor Vladimir Romanovsky of the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute says permafrost from the Brooks Range south is becoming unstable. He says when permafrost that's a mix of ice and soil melts, the water often flows away and the surface sinks.
It's not just everything sinking evenly, but there is some dips and troughs and all kind of thing develops, which for infrastructure is the worst case scenario.
The Alaska Department of Transportation and Public Facilities Chief of Maintenance and Operations, Mike Coffey, says as permafrost thaws, it takes more time and money to keep roads in shape.
When it thaws, then we, maintenance and operations, spend just about all summer up north fighting, you know, the roller coaster ride. So we're removing pavement and re-leveling, smoothing roads, and then repaving or chip sealing back over the top to try and smooth the roads out.
Coffey says during most of the 32 years he's been with the Department of Transportation, Fairbanks winters were cold.
Historically, in the fall, they instantly were close, you know, very suddenly went below zero, and they stayed below zero until the spring.
Now, Coffey says, warmer temperatures are changing maintenance requirements for Fairbanks roads.
We're getting freeze-thaw, freeze-thaw, freeze-thaw. We're getting freezing rain events. We had the huge rainstorm in January, and I think that was 2011. And so the way it's forced us to change the way we do our winter maintenance operations, in that we're actually now having to do anti-icing in the Fairbanks area, which 10 or 15 years ago probably wouldn't have ever been thought of.
Jack Abair is founder and CEO of the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks. He says melting permafrost can also damage building foundations, putting houses at a tilt. Sometimes houses sink into the ground or the soil subsides, leaving stairs dangling above the ground. But Abair says there are ways to save a structure whose foundation is damaged.
It's called slab jacking. You can actually lift parts of the foundation that are failing. That can either be done with a fluid, even concrete, or it can be done with a slab jacking foam, and that pushes the foundation back up.
Also in Fairbanks, some hillside residents have seen their wells run dry, and some downhill have seen their basements fill with water as permafrost melts. Abair says mortgage funders and some municipalities now require soil tests, so homes are not built on permafrost at high risk of thawing. Other climate change effects range from disastrous to inconvenient. Mike Brubaker, director of the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium Center for Climate Change and Health, says people can prepare for climate change by increasing local self-sufficiency, food, water, and energy security.
And it's something that's, you know, always been a challenge and always been a priority for small rural Alaska communities. And I think we just have to continue to work on that and to make sure as opportunity presents itself, through construction, through investment, through development, that we're making good decisions and helping to make our communities as climate resilient as possible.
While there may be challenging times ahead, Jack Abair says he's still optimistic for the future.
We can learn and work together on finding ways to address this climatic change that we're experiencing, just as in many other ways we have to adapt to the times that we're living in. I think we've got the talent to do that up here. It's going to take research. It's going to take commitment. And working together, I think we can get there.
Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
The sport of flat track roller derby is booming in Alaska. There are more than a dozen leagues in the state, from the North Pole Babes to the Sitka Sound Slayers, with 29 members. And the derby they're playing is not the derby of 40 years ago. KCAW's Emily Kwong has the story.
Off the track, these 29 women are teachers, commercial fisherwomen, and stay-at-home moms. But on the track, they're a force of raw female power.
Hot Wheels!
La Femme Nikita.
Ivana Gidanya.
Kippered Smacks.
I'm the Filthy Oar.
Sin and Tonic.
Sodium Chloride.
Bevolution.
Valkyrie.
Chooser of the Slain.
Meet the Sitka Sound Slayers. Their logo is a skull with crossed halibut and gaff hooks. Yes, they skate in fishnets and lipstick, but also helmets and mouthguards. Roller derby is tough to play and addictive to watch. Their last bout with the Garnet Grit Bettys of Wrangell sold out in 5 days.
I typically have very thick glasses and wear ridiculous dresses. My goal in life is to be Miss Frizzle by day.
Bridget Whitcomb is a 7th grade science teacher.
And so my students will see me and they're like, wait, I know you, who are you? And they get really upset because then they realize, oh my God, it's Miss Whitcomb.
I was missing athleticism in my life.
Corey Shimeda played basketball in college and is now the league president. She goes by Valkyrie and sometimes warms up with Viking horns on her head.
There was that point where I felt like I had my professional life and then I was a mom, and there was no little slice of that for me. And I think women are looking for a place to be competitive.
Players skate on a flat track, not a bank track. And safety is paramount. There's no punching, no elbowing, no clotheslining. In other words, modern derby is not the derby you may remember from a few decades ago. According to the National Museum of Roller Skating, it all started with a TV publicist named Leo Seltzer, who was losing money during the Great Depression. He decided to organize these marathon skating events and sold tickets.
Green sport fans all set for another roller derby game.
The public loved it, even more so when players began exaggerating their falls and elbowing opponents. Seltzer tried to curtail this fake play, but it was too late. By the 1970s, roller derby was part theater, part wrestling, a raucous, rage-filled spectacle with staged fights and little regulation.
The gal from France, a model.
In this bout between the Los Angeles Thunderbirds and the Chicago Hawks, one skater grabs another by her collar and slings her across the track into the medical bench.
Into the medical bench and over the top.
And she's not wearing a helmet. The crowd goes wild.
4 points, and we're going to have an interview coming up. And
so how did Derby go from that to this?
Extraordinarily independent, fiercely feminist, as far as I can tell, and pretty unapologetic about where we see women in the world or where we see sports in the economy.
Juliana Gonzalez is the executive director of the Women's Flat Track Derby Association. Globally, the WFTDA has roughly 400 leagues, representing about 25,000 athletes. Gonzalez explains that while roller derby has retained elements of its former self, the power structure has flipped. The female skaters run their own leagues, not an outside owner or a commercial interest. For Gonzalez, derby's fundamental autonomy is why leagues are springing up around the world.
Our sport is not designed with the intention of getting recognition from the sporting world. There is such an incredible appeal to a movement that will say, we stand for ourselves. We're glad you like it. Join us.
And women in Alaska are heeding that call. There are member leagues in Wasilla, Fairbanks, Anchorage, and Juneau. The Slayers hope to one day join the WFTDA. But for now, they're mostly savoring the house they've built right at home.
I really love Sitka's audience because they just come alive and it really just breathes fire into the skaters.
Courtney MacArthur's derby name is Bevolution, a tribute to how the sport radically changed her life. She has a tattoo on her arm of a little girl praying to a Barbie doll.
I always thought I had okay self-esteem, but looking back, it's like, no, I didn't. It was connected to all these other unhealthy things. I get my sense of self from a completely different place now, and I take pride in completely different things, like being strong, being fast, being healthy.
Roller derby was a sport invented by a man, no argument. But it is definitely women who are taking it back. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Emily Kwong.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis in Delta, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Zachariah Hughes, Ann Hillman, and Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, and Emily Kwong in Sitka. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.